You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Hey there. Ever wonder what happens to all those amazing screenplays that never make it to the big screen? Well, wonder no more. Welcome to Table Read Podcast, where we bring those undiscovered gems to life. Picture this, talented actors giving incredible performances with the occasional laugh or blooper thrown in, produced by award-winning pros. From drama to comedy, TV pilots to feature films, there's something for everyone. And guess what? We release new episodes every week, so don't forget to hit that subscribe button. Table Read Podcast, where great stories finally get their chance to shine.
This podcast is being brought to you by Voyage AC.
Hey, do you know why Voyage AC's bedtime spray is so relaxing?
The essential oils? Mm-hmm. The chamomile? Mm-hmm. Maybe the Bulgarian rose?
Yes, all of that. But did you also know that the crystal lipidolite Melanie uses in the bedtime spray releases just a teeny bit of lithium?
Lithium? Wait, wasn't lithium called Mother's Little Helper back in the 50s?
Precisely, hun, because of its relaxing properties. But now you have all the benefits of that and all these other amazing organic, aromatic ingredients in Voyage AC's bedtime spray. Just one spritz and you're off to dreamland.
You mean I'm off to dreamland? Sometimes I drift off while you're still spritzing the pillows.
That's so true. You want to check out this bedtime spray and all of Voyage AC's beautiful candles, phenomenal fragrances, and gorgeous face and body products. So how can our listeners find Voyage AC?
Well, you can find everything on their website at www.voyageac.com. That's VOYAGEETCIE.com.
And as you know, Melanie is willing to give my friends and family discount to all our listeners right now. That's 10% off everything you buy.
All you need to do is enter the only one at checkout.
That's right. All you have to do is enter the only one when you make your purchase. Voyage AC is the ultimate luxury blend of travel, design, and scents. Each original fragrance, every candle is handmade, 100% natural vegetable blend, and created by Melanie personally.
Several times a week, Laura will turn to me after we get into bed and say those six little words I've been waiting to hear all day. Can I read something to you? Once I've said yes, she reaches for an item from her very cluttered nightstand and proceeds to bring that book, blog post, poem, essay, or article to life with her voice. I hope you enjoy listening to her read as much as I do. Here's this week's selection from Laura's nightstand.
Yes, as Scott said, this is On My Nightstand. I am Laura Cathcart Robbins, just brimming with excitement to read this next piece to you. It is by our dear friend, Holly Whitaker. Holly has been on The Only One in the Room twice, and I'm going to be reading an excerpt from her book, Quit Like a Woman, her New York Times bestselling book, I might add, both hardcover and paperback. And the essay itself is called Quit Like a Woman. And here's just a little bit about Holly. Holly is the founder and CEO of Tempest, an online membership community that supports a life without alcohol. She is also the author of the best-selling book, Quit Like a Woman, The Radical Choice Not to Drink in a Culture Obsessed with Alcohol. So like I said, this is an excerpt from that book. Nearly a decade ago, about a year before I stopped drinking alcohol, a friend of mine showed up at my door. It was early on a Saturday afternoon, and my friend was carrying a solo cup full of whiskey. because some man she'd met on OkCupid had broken her heart. It seemed a reasonable solution to me at the time, to walk around the streets of San Francisco, sipping Maker's Mark to dull the specific pain of being rejected by someone she'd met on the internets, who wasn't good enough for her in the first place. Only I would have chosen Jameson. We called a few friends to come over, and we sat in my little studio apartment, smoking pot and drinking even more whiskey and cheap wine from the corner store, when my dear, broken-hearted friend announced to the group that she was pretty sure she was going through a, quote, alcoholic phase, unquote. Alcoholic phase. I looked around the room at the faces of my other friends for a hint of the same reaction I felt, which was relief. I saw not only looks of relief, but also ones of deep knowing. We'd all experienced something close enough to that to empathize. Huh. When you're terrified that maybe your drinking has gone off the rails, nothing will rein in that hysterical, ridiculous thought more tightly than a group of successful, intelligent, attractive, together women who normalize your affliction with a new term, alcoholic phase. This scenario is only one of a few hundred examples of why I couldn't figure out whether I really had a problem with alcohol or if maybe I was going through a little quote-unquote thing that would straighten itself out. Around the time of this particular incident, when I was 33, my drinking was escalating in a way that felt out of control. It was no longer just one or two at home, or a drunk night out with the girls, or hangovers on the weekends, or any of the things I'd done in my 20s that felt moderately in control or normalish. I was drinking by myself after going out. I was hungover more days than not. Keeping it to a bottle of wine a night felt like a win. 5 o'clock stopped coming fast enough, and I started to leave work at 4:45, then 4:30. Then 4 p.m. At some point, it made sense to carry airline shots in my purse, just in case. Sometimes, especially when working on a deadline, I holed up in my apartment for days on end, drinking from morning until I passed out. That kind of thing. But, and there is always a but, when you want to invalidate everything you just said, I didn't drink every night, and I didn't drink any more than my friends when we went out. I'd recently made it 12 days without booze, and perhaps, most important to me, I had mastered the art of keeping my shit together when drunk in public. I was never the one being carried home. I was never the one who got sloppy. I made sure of that. To my mind, there was enough evidence to prove I was a quote-unquote normal drinker, and equally enough evidence to qualify me for the Betty Ford. I went back and forth between knowing I needed major help and thinking if I just did one more fucking yoga, I'd be fine. My passage into sobriety was both slow and fast. Slow in that it took me 17 years to realize alcohol had never done me any favors. 17 years of trying to control it and master it and make it work for me like I imagined it work for all the other people. Fast, in the sense that once I crossed that invisible line, one I still can't trace, I was hurtling so quickly toward a total dissolution that I couldn't pretend to have the strength to stave off what was happening to me. The whole thing was like that Price is Right game, where the little yodeler is climbing the mountain and you never know where he's going to stop or how far he's going to make it, but you know he has the potential to go all the way. It might be helpful to mention that during this time, I was simply killing it at work. I joined a startup in 2009, and because I was a cutthroat workaholic with a habit of fucking men in charge, in a few short years, I landed a director title, something typically reserved for Ivy League MBAs who favored Ann Taylor pinstripes. It was a healthcare company, and many of my friends were medical doctors, so I dropped in to see one of them about my quote-unquote thing. I explained that I might have a teeny tiny drinking issue and a habit of throwing up most of the things I ate. And when she had to Google how to treat me and suggested Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew I was completely screwed. I bought wine on the way home from that appointment because I wasn't an alcoholic and there was no way in hell I was going to AA. But over the course of the next 18 months, one by one. I stopped drinking, smoking pot, taking all recreational drugs, and I got over my bulimia. I started meditating and crawled out of the depths of depression, addiction, sickness, and crushing debt. Within 20 months of that afternoon with my friends, drinking room temperature whiskey and pondering if maybe all of us are sick or none of us are, I also quit my job. I did this because I had finally become someone who, A, wasn't the kind of woman who reports to someone she's been sleeping with, and B, had pure reason to exist. I knew I was supposed to start a revolution around alcohol, addiction, and recovery. What I didn't know was exactly how I would do that, or that this revolution would become stronger with strands of activism and energy woven into major social forces, fourth wave and intersectional feminism, the reaction to Trump's election, the legalization of marijuana in several states, the Black Lives Matter movement, the opioid crisis, and the growing vocalized dissent against a very racist, classist, imperialist, and failed war on drugs. This journey had been an evolving one. At first, it was the story of a dead woman walking, and all the women in the world who try to conform to a way of life they are told they should want, one that looks good on paper. I drank green juice and made the right sounds when I fucked men I didn't really like, and crushed it in the boardroom, and traveled to Central America all by myself, and my ass was yoga tight. I did all the right things until all the right things became so suffocating I wound up prostrate, drunk, on the floor of my apartment. It was then that the journey of a woman waking up to the world and all its possibilities and wonder, her own power and voice and unique identity, the bigness that a life can be when we center it on our true desires compared to the smallness of the one we accept when we center it on the desires we're supposed to have. That personal awakening was followed by the part where I discovered that alcohol was not only something I could not abide, but perhaps something we all shouldn't. And that was paralleled by the part where I discovered that the systems in place to help me stop drinking the chemical we've been trained to tolerate, the chemical that was physically and emotionally and mentally murdering me, were archaic, patriarchal, masculine, and hence ineffective for me as a non-man. I discovered that I not only had to claw my way out of hell and construct my own system for recovery, but that also, perhaps, it was my duty to create something more so the women who come after me, women who are dying in broad daylight while we look the other way, might not have to face the same bullshit I had to endure. We are living at a time in history where more and more women are waking up to their infinite potential and calling out the systems that hold them down and keep them quiet, submissive, sick, second to, voiceless, and out of power. We have more socioeconomic and political clout than ever before. The movements started by women of color, the LGBTQIA community, and radical feminists have gained considerable momentum, and we've reached a tipping point. More of us are aware of the terms of our own oppression and of our own complicity in the oppression of others. Words like misogyny, patriarchy, tone policing, white privilege, and gaslighting have become common lexicon. Women, now more than any other time in history, are conscious of our collective subjugation. And yet, this is also a time in which women are drinking more than we have ever before. Between 2002 and 2012, the rates of alcohol addiction among women rose by 84%, as in nearly doubled. 1 in 10 American women will die an alcoholic-related death. And from 2007 to 2017, alcohol-related deaths among women rose 67%, as opposed to 29% among men. It is a time of radical progression in almost every area of our collective experience, and a time of unprecedented rates of addiction coupled with an almost gross ambivalence toward our own personal and societal relationship with alcohol. Here is the time in history where the future is female, the wine is pink, the yoga classes serve beer, and the death toll rises. Here is the time in history where masses of us women fill the streets to protest against external oppression, then celebrate or cope or come down from it all with a glass of self-administered oppression. This book is about all these things, about the sickness in our society that drives us toward an unattainable perfection and lives we never bargained for, and what we do to manage that impossible situation. It's about an addictive chemical that we have been fooled into believing is the answer to every problem, a healthful staple to our diet, our key to connection and power. It's about a system that limits our ability to question whether we should be consuming that addictive chemical, and one that, when we do addicted, forces us into male-centric recovery frameworks, i.e. Alcoholics Anonymous, that not only run counter to our emerging feminist and individualistic ideals, but actively work against them, boarding us through yet another system that requires submission to male authority, self-silencing, further dissolution of self, and pathologized femininity. In other words, this book is about what makes us sick and keeps us sick. It's about our power as women, both as individuals and as a collective, and how alcohol can keep us from it. And most important, it is about what is possible when we remove alcohol from our lives and destroy our belief systems around it. This is the truth about alcohol. And the thing about the truth is once you know it, you can never unknow it. You will never look at drinking the same way again. On My Nightstand is a special segment of the Only One in the Room podcast. Today's episode was produced by Scott Slaughter, who I call Hun, and executively produced by Christina Barcy, who we call Barcy. Thank you for listening to The Only One in the Room. Please join us each Tuesday and Sunday for an incredible, brand new Only One interview, and every Friday for On My Nightstand, where I'll be reading from something that I love. If you have an Only One in the Room story or a piece of writing that you'd like to share, please submit it to theonlyonepod@gmail.com. From all of us at The Only One in the Room, we wish you dopeness, health, and prosperity.
Hello, dear stranger. I'd like to introduce you to something new, or perhaps something very, very old. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine is a horror fantasy medical mystery following the titular monk turned traveling medical investigator. Follow Radolf as he navigates a nightmare world in which viruses are gods and the human race are not their favored children. Steeped in history and an aesthetic that can only be described as a combination of occult academia and laboratory Judaica, the Heresies of Radolf Burntwine have been described as Umberto Eco meets H.P. Lovecraft. For more information, check out the Patreon at thorb.info. But take care, dear stranger, for some truths are best left unknown.